Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Alex Kratosky. And now prepare to discover what my brain sounds like.
Guna isi huka hupa. No woe iso ya ho.
Seriously, that is where my head is at the minute. Actually, I'll come clean. That's Simlish, the language of the Sims, the little computer people whose dynasty has sold over 95 million copies, dominating the top slot for PC games for almost a decade. This week at the Electronic Entertainment Expo in Los Angeles, the latest iteration of the franchise, Sims 3, was unveiled. And actually Bobby Johnson was there. Also on today's podcast, the furore surrounding the alleged release of Last.fm data to the recording industry of America, implicating all their users who listen to music via their service that was not accessed originally via above-the-board means. Jemima Kish digs through the dirt generated by tech blog TechCrunch to get the details direct from the top trio at Last.fm. We're also asking whether the discovery of Google's top secret location for all their data servers means that they could now be a terrorist target, plus all the rest of this week's news. Joining me to debate this and everything else is Bobby Johnson, who this week is at E3, and internet scribe Will Head, on loan from The Gadget Show, The Register, and many other fine technology publications. Will, so what do you think would happen if Google disappeared?
If Google disappeared, I think everyone would forget how to do anything at all in life, in general. I mean, how would you even get to the shops without Google being there?
I had a theory, actually, the other night that Wikipedia is like Google Plus. You know, everybody used to use Google to find out information about stuff, right? And now you just use Google to find out services, but you use Wikipedia to find out information about stuff.
That is true. And also, you do have to watch out for the time suck of Wikipedia. That as soon as you start looking at one page, there's another link off that one. And you start looking at... And next thing you know, an hour's gone and you haven't got anything done.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Normally, that's applied to something like Twitter. Anyway, Bobby, what's happening in Los Angeles?
Oh, sorry. I was just looking at Wikipedia. Everybody's interested to see what happens, because the last couple of years E3's been really low-key, downbeat, industry insiders only kind of affair. So no more of the glitz and glamour of the old days, I'm afraid.
That suits me down to the ground. Anyway, as always, we'll be hearing from you, the listeners, from The Guardian's blogs and via the social media superhighway. So stay tuned for the next 30 or so minutes for the tech trip of your life. No, really. Last February, US technology blog TechCrunch made some allegations that the music recommendation service Last.fm had scraped its users' listening habits and handed over a massive list of potential copyright infringers to the RIAA. Needless to say, the shizzle hit the fan. Last.fm immediately fired back several denials, claiming that they had not, nor did they intend to, produce such a list. Indeed, doing such a thing would break the laws of several international data doctrines. Now, Bobby, you've been following this story. What's the latest?
The initial story back in February caused a bit of a storm, but was never really resolved. Over the bank holiday weekend just gone, TechCrunch kind of reiterated its story and referred to another anonymous source. This is all from anonymous sources apparently inside or related to CBS, which owns Last.fm. Anyway, the kind of new twist on the story is that actually TechCrunch has said it wasn't Last.fm that handed over the data, but it was its paymasters at CBS who took the data and then handed it over to the Recording Industry Association of America. The big controversy here is not only are they accused of passing data on to an organisation which most people on the internet are fairly critical of, I think that's an understatement, but also actually because Last.fm is a British company, even though it's owned by an American organisation, they could be breaking data protection laws by moving this data across borders and giving it to other organisations. So, you know, it's a big, serious accusation there.
Well, Tech Weekly's Jemima Kish was invited to speak with the Last.fm team earlier this week to hear their rebuttal firsthand. She started by asking them what the biggest difference is between the last time she met them 2 years ago and now.
We're dealing with so much more people now using our website. I mean, generally, that's been the story, right? At the beginning, we did it for our mates. And And now there's more than 30 million users every month using the website. I think that's definitely changed.
I also think that, at least for me, now that we've got this much, much bigger audience, it changes your behaviour a little bit. Because in the past, when we were much smaller, we could just do stuff almost like on a whim, change that, try that, oh, we broke it, let's fix it, whatever. And everyone was very understanding. And so now we're at this size, you have to think twice before just changing something.
There's more people to moan.
People are inherently, they just don't like change.
Yeah.
So you have to really be sure of what you're going to do if you make a change.
I guess in some ways the CBS acquisition took some pressure off, because you're not having to sort of, you know, scurry around looking for funding, etc., etc. But it must also have put pressure on, because obviously they're going to want to see, you know, the bottom line and stuff.
The pressure was always on, I guess.
For us, I mean, I think the pressure was, as you said, bigger, and we were independent, because you do run out of money. And then when you do run out of money, you have like usually sort of like a 6-month horizon. And if you don't have a good story, you might just end up being dead. So I think the risk in that sense has obviously been lowered. But we always knew that we need to make this work as a business. We can't just, whatever, be the next big thing and then be bored.
The real big challenge is then to make that into a sustainable business, especially if you're talking with these complex revenue streams that we have with the music industry. But we really like that challenge. It's an interesting one.
Well, I have to ask about that, of course. So how's it going, making money?
It's good. Everything's ramping up still for us.
And are you profitable?
We can't divulge these intimate details.
I know, but I have to ask. Spotify, as a user, it seems like it does a very different thing to me, because if I know what I want to listen to, then I can go to Spotify and find it, but that's not really what I want to do with music. I like finding new stuff. Is that a fair sort of characterization?
That's very valid, because Spotify doesn't make that easy. I think Spotify deserves the utmost credit for making listening to music a lot easier. Awesome. But I think that there's more to technology than just making stuff easier, as in like something that existed before. But what does all this music mean? How does it relate to me? How do I find new stuff? And even if I don't want to find a lot, how can I find these few bits and pieces that really interest me, and how can I burrow deeper into what I'm really into, etc. And I think how we see music is like connective tissue for us. So music is the medium, is not the message. Something like that. So it's not about listening to music, it's about all that stuff that comes with music, you know, knowing about an artist, you know, what's the newest pictures by that artist, you know, what are they doing, are they starting a new trend in clothing, crazy stuff like Lady Gaga, God knows what, and then I think there's also a lot of value in just entertaining people without them having to do very much. So this whole notion of going to Last.fm and deciding something, a genre or an artist name, and pressing play and just letting it run, is genius, because it takes the burden of, you know, decision off you. My iPod drives me crazy. It's like, I hate my iPod. It's dumb. The only thing you can do is shuffle, or if I really feel like listening to something, I can do it.
And so the usability thing about Spotify, the fact that they've sort of replicated the iTunes interface, is obviously quite a
genius,
quite a clever thing to do. Do you wish you'd thought of that?
I don't think we would add any value by just making listening to music easier, because we add value by entertaining people or
recommending them new stuff. Huh?
But why do you think they've managed to get so much press?
Because it's still awesome. Everybody knows iTunes, and when you're sitting in front of an iTunes like software that plays any song ever, I mean, it's great. It's
good. So you're not that worried about them, but maybe you would be if they added a sort of social.
Some of our users are into Spotify, and they actually implemented Scrabbling in some of their clients.
Straight away, right.
Due to the popular demand of their user base. And people use Last.fm for all the other stuff, you know, the charts, the recommendations, the gigs. And then once they sort of have found something they want to listen to it some more, they'll go to Spotify and scrabble the data back to Last.fm. It's a virtuous cycle in a way. It's not really up to us to say where you should listen to music. We're about sort of gathering that data and then adding value by recommending and connecting with us.
Okay, that's a good point. Is TechCrunch full of shit?
Definitely. There's really not much to add. We don't know who it is, and we don't know why they're doing it, but we know that it's a bunch of lies, and TechCrunch obviously believed it.
And
it seems like Arrington's having second thoughts now from his more recent comments about, oh, now my source is saying that it may have happened, not that it did happen, blah, blah, blah. So it seems like it's starting to crumble a bit, but
And there are a few theories that it was some rogue person at CBS that might have been able to get some data, not the really meaningful data, but some data, and then might have passed it on thinking it was being helpful.
But there's a lot of data available on the website for everybody. They're most welcome to have a look at everything. Record labels and the RIAA maybe have been looking at this for a long time.
Well, we know that labels use our website to like research things and stuff like that. That's not news. But the fact that the IP address is linked to user data and who's playing what is like so closely guarded here. It's kept under lock and key. We don't actually release it to anybody. We don't even transfer it out of the organisation to CBS. So there's absolutely no way that what was alleged to happen could have happened.
That was Martin Stixel, Felix Miller and RJ from Last FM. So, Will.
It's actually very hard to ascertain actually who did what in this whole thing. That's the big problem with this, I think, at the moment, is TechCrunch is saying one thing, Last FM is saying another, and we're still not actually sure who gave what to anyone, if indeed they did hand over anything at all. So I think it's probably unlikely that Last FM themselves did, because I think I read somewhere that they said that they employ open source super geek wizards who are sort of big on the, we like to keep everything sort of privacy, all of that kind of thing, protect that side of things of it. And also they were sort of a startup. They were very Web.2-y, and that's where you had to have, your users were the important thing. And even though they're owned by CBS, they're over here. They're not out where CBS is based. So they probably still maintain that kind of ethos. So I'd say unlikely that Last FM did it. If CBS did, because obviously they have, I think they own a record company as well, they obviously have to keep in with the RIAA. I don't know. I mean, would they even be able to get hold of the data? I think that's the thing we're being told at the moment, is that that data is locked up so tightly inside Last FM that even CBS can't get to it. So maybe someone found a backdoor in, I don't know. But I would say that's the only thing. If it was down to someone at CBS, because they're kind of like pushing the rebuttal back to Last FM to say that they didn't leak the data.
See, this makes me think of MPs' expenses, doesn't it? You know, some subversive, somebody who nobody actually can pinpoint.
Yes.
Accidentally leaked it to somebody, and who knows if it's for any purposes. I mean, Bobby, what would be in it for Last FM if they did do it, CBS if they did it, for TechCrunch? I mean, what's in it for all the parties involved?
Well, I think from the company's side of things, from CBS's point of view, you know, it's important to them that the Recording Industry Association of America is kind of kept on side. You know, they're a big and very litigious group who carry on this fight against file sharing. What it comes down to is very difficult journalistic decision that you make when you have anonymous sources who, you know, for whatever reason you can't reveal their identity, but you have to kind of sanity check it and decide whether they're telling you the truth, what the real situation is here. I think the issue I have, TechCrunch stands by its story. It's very strong, you know, it's come back and told the same story again, so it obviously believes it. I think what I would like to see is some kind of hard documentary evidence that proves this one way or the other.
You mentioned on the opener of this item that it was illegal. Can you explain a little bit about why that is and how the UK would respond to this if the allegations were true?
The Data Protection Act in the UK says you essentially that you can't export users' private data to another country. You know, that's the crux of it. And if there is something that's happened here, there's a potential action that can be taken. The first step would be probably an investigation by the privacy watchdog, the information commissioner, who would go and have a look at this. And if he felt it necessary to take some action, he would. There's, you know, it could potentially open up a civil lawsuit or something like that, that in which users could either take on CBS or Last FM itself and you know, sue over the fact that their data was effectively stolen, because, you know, the Data Protection Act says you own your own data and people can't trade it without your permission.
Well, you can follow the mudslinging match, which is what you called it, Bobby, on The Guardian, on guardian.co.uk/technology. In the meantime, keep your scrubbers off, if you have anything to hide, that is. Now, here's Jemima with more of this week's technology news.
Microsoft has launched Bing, its Google killer search service, aiming to offer a more consumer-focused search in the shopping, health, travel, and local business sectors. The name, according to Microsoft, refers to the sound of found. At the E3 conference, Microsoft also revealed new partners for the next incarnation of the Xbox, attempting to broaden the appeal of the console. Last.fm, Twitter, and Facebook will all feature, as well as live Sky TV. BT has come under fire for capping broadband use for customers on cheaper tariffs without warning, cutting the speed during peak evening times. The limits have affected iPlayer and YouTube users, while many have complained of speeds as low as 5 megabytes per second. Data gathered by Royal Pingdom has identified some of Google's secret main data centres, with 19 pinned down in the US, 12 in Europe and 3 in Asia. Google's earnings show the tech giant spent $2.4 billion on data centres in 2007, and each one costs around $600 million to build and equip.
So, Will, what are the security implications for Google now that these data centres are so widely known?
I think probably one of the big problems would be if somebody did want to take Google out, they would have a bigger way of doing it now, obviously, because they can just target the specific locations. But I would say that Google probably has already anticipated this. And it deals with a lot of data every probably second of the day, and it needs to make sure that connections are going to go down, that kind of thing. So it probably has ways that work around sort of shifting this data around sort of fairly autonomously. So even if one data center went down, it could probably recover from that quite easily. I think the problem would be if sort of more than one or two went out. And also if there are only sort of UK ones, it could probably shift to Germany or France, but then you then start sort of ending with transatlantic links and that kind of thing, and extra slower internet connections, that kind of thing.
Global thermonuclear war. I can just see it. Bobby, who would want to attack them? I mean, what would be the purpose of attacking these data centers?
Well, I think, you know, it would either be some kind of attack that targeted Google specifically as a company, or that targeted Google as a kind of representative of maybe, you know, of Western culture. It's interesting, a few weeks ago here in California, somebody cut through a major data pipeline in Silicon Valley that knocked out a couple, you know, like 100,000 houses and offices in the South Valley, and nobody's really sure who did it. There's a bounty out for the head of the person who did it. But basically, they sliced through some cables, and it looks like they did it on purpose. So I think, you know, there's been lots of talk about hackers and cyber war and all this kind of stuff. I think, you know, maybe Google is a target. Maybe other companies are targets too, for some kind of politically motivated attack.
I think you hit it before, actually, Will, about this idea of everything being distributed and they'd probably be able to pick it up. I'm remembering, I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, that when I lived in DC back in 96, something happened to AOL. And at that point, everybody in the US was pretty much accessing their internet via AOL.
And
everybody
disappeared.
Freaked. Yeah, I mean, literally freaked. In the same way, Bobby, I imagine people freaked out in Silicon Valley. But now, how much of an impact do you think somebody attacking Google's data centers would actually have on the web nowadays?
If you took Google out of the internet, how would anyone find anything? Obviously, you've got other search engines are available, but pretty much Google is the number one. Also, you've got other things like Gmail as well. If it took out Gmail, a lot of people use that. There's Google News, where people use to browse and find sort of stories to read. I mean, there is a lot more to Google than just a search engine as well. So
it's quite exciting. Actually, speaking of the other search engines that are available,
yes,
we mentioned Bing. Can you tell me what is Bing? Is it, you know, what's the story?
It's Microsoft's latest attempt to try and kill Google from the look of things. And it's hard to say because Google isn't bad, really. I think that's the thing. When Google came out, you had four or five competing search engines, and none of them were very good. So you had to sort of do a search in a few of them to try and find what you were looking for. And Google kind of changed that. And even though there are problems with Google, especially with search engine spam and people filling it up, and it's a constant war to try and keep those people out, but even still, it's still largely a very useful resource. And I think Google's pretty good at staying on top of that it doesn't give much of an opening to Microsoft to come in. But one thing people have said that this is quite good at is product searches. So if you're looking at information on a particular product, you'll get reviews and you'll get sort of the specs and that kind of thing rather than the people trying to sell you things, which is what Google is increasingly being filled up with.
Bobby, have you had a chance to have a go on Bing?
Yeah, I've binged a little.
and does your binging work?
I really think that this game is over. I think that Microsoft has shown that it's still really at least a step behind Google, because, you know, we're all looking at what's the future of search, and effectively what Microsoft is saying is that they believe the future is exactly the same as it was, just kind of with a few prettier aspects to it and
Bingy graphics.
And you can dig down and stuff. I mean, there are some neat things. You know, you can autoplay videos from inside Bing search results, which is a bit bizarre. If you want to go and search for porn on the internet, you can watch it straight from inside Bing, apparently.
Well, on that note, other search engines are available, porn or not. You can read up on all these news stories by heading to guardian.co.uk/technology. It's Video Games Week on The Guardian, and we've gone game crazy thanks to the high-profile return of E3, the flashiest interactive expo in the West. And horrors, the 20th anniversary of Tetris. Is that right, Bobby? 20?
25th.
Stop adding years to my life. Anyway, it's also a big week for another industry mainstay, which is The Sims. This PC title, which is the biggest selling franchise in Europe and North America, Super Mario Brothers pings it in most of the other territories, is about to hit its third milestone with the release of The Sims 3.
You are their creator. You giveth them life and spirit. Unleash them upon the world and do unto them whatever you want. Let there be The Sims 3.
Let there be The Observer's David Smith, who we sent to meet Rod Humble and Ben Bell, who told us a little bit about what to expect from our new computerized neighborhood.
It features the most advanced personality simulator ever put in a computer game. Our Sims are much more alive and intelligent than they've ever been before. They give you a lot more pushback and depth. Also, it features a far greater depth of gameplay in terms of tasks and things you can do within that world and the interactions. And it also is an open world. So for the first time ever in a Sims game, you can look across the street, see your kids' neighbors playing. You can, when you get a job, you have to drive to work. You literally get to see the entire world. All of these things go on in a little clockwork world that's living on your computer.
How real can a personality simulator be?
When we were designing the game, for example, we looked at dating ads of how people actually look for stereotypes of, shy, like speeches. So we actually take those things and we put them in the game. And we put a system that we call moodlets, which also impacts on how your sim feels. So, and if your sim is wet, then they'll have a mood that they get caught in the rain. They can have a moodlet that will negatively impact their mood. I don't know how real, but I can certainly tell you it's pretty entertaining.
And how does a British person come to be involved?
Blind luck, I think. No, before I got this job, I was running the EverQuest studio for Sony Online, and I joined here about 3.5 years ago. I came to the United States to make games back in 1990. So I've been here a while. But I think Britain has punched above its weight in terms of game developers within the industry. And a lot of it is that video games didn't hit in the United Kingdom. Computer games did earlier. So instead of the Atari and the old Nintendo 8-bit, we had the Sinclair Spectrum. And then we had, you know, the Commodore 64. And what the difference that made was you could actually make games as opposed to simply playing them. And I think that if you look at British game development, you know, the Rockstar guys making the Grand Theft Auto series, we've really punched above our weight, and a lot of it goes back to that very early first introduction of kids was, hey, I really enjoyed that game. Oh, and now I can make one because it's a computer. So I think that's a big deal.
What we're recording today is Sims 3 child voice. What you're going to see is Simlish as we created on the fly. It's not a say these words type of script. It's this is what we want you to communicate. Nikki's been with us long enough that we don't have any cheat sheets or use anything with her, but most of the new talent we work with cheat sheets of good Simlish words. And then as we get better with the talent, we let them freer and freer.
Nikki, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can totally hear you.
All right. So this is chatting on a sofa.
So we play off hand gestures a whole lot. We don't have a hard lip sync model. So we play hands a whole lot, head movements. The movement of the mouth is actually the animator's idea. So we just fill them in as we can.
I don't want to go to bed. Right, that rhythm, but don't, not the kind of petulant thing. I want to watch my show.
I'm Ben Bell. I'm the executive producer of Sims 3. If you watch the news or if you watch reality shows, you sort of learn real life is kind of the ultimate fiction. So I think there's nothing that's off limits in terms of what we can do with The Sims and where they go in life.
Does The Sims have a political ethos at the moment? I mean, I think it was said of SimCity that there seems to be an emphasis on low taxes, but at the same time on using public transport rather than cars. I mean, could The Sims address something like climate change, for example?
We never really tried to make political statements with The Sims, but I think that, naturally, because the center of, of our creativity is player creativity, that we're all about enabling that expression. And that says something about, how we feel. We feel like the most interesting thing that's going on is what the players have to bring to the game, and that's kind of a powerful statement about our political position, I think.
And a lot is still sort of written and talked about online multiplayer games, mm-hmm. Second Life and various others. I mean, the focus is still offline. For the sort of the non-expert, why is that? And is it, would some people say it's inevitable that one day The Sims is going to be predominantly online?
Well, I think that even though you play the game, as a single player, that The Sims is inherently connected to online experiences because so many of our players create content and share it. And that The Sims Exchange is incredibly popular. And, one thing that... that is true over and over again is what people are doing with their Sims game is something that's really personal to them. That's why The Sims is so powerful, because you can do something personal in it. And, people don't necessarily want to share that all the time. So I don't know that, I think there will always be some people who want to play The Sims, by themselves, and do their thing with it.
That was Ben Bell, executive producer of The Sims 3. Also The Observer's David Smith. The Sims 3, Bobby. Are you excited?
I like The Sims. I know it gets a rough ride from some people, but I've always been a fan of it. I think what you have to realise as well is how enormous this game is, how many people play it, and kind of get sucked in and never to emerge. I think what I wonder is in 10 or 20 years or something, if The Sims will have some kind of major lasting impact on people's lives just because so many people play it. Will we be sitting here talking about it in the future?
I mean, I suppose my resistance to it is more that it doesn't feel as if there's anything new here, whether it's coming out of the franchise or whether it's coming out of the kind of the zeitgeist of electronic dolls houses. Will and I were saying that it feels almost like it's a dated construct. Is it still relevant?
I think when you're the kind of edgy people that we are, always looking for new stuff, The Sims looks boring and similar and doesn't change very much. I think it's maybe not as innovative as it was back in the day, but I think it's I think it's a bit harsh to have a go at it, really. It's a big game that lots of people like playing.
Well, you're not a big gamer, but no. You've heard about the Sims franchise. Do you think what Bobby was saying about, you know, in a few years' time, we might be sitting and talking about the impact that the Sims had on the universe? Do you see that as happening, or what's your take on this franchise?
I don't know. I can't... For me, it just seems things like mundane things like getting a job. You have a job, you have to do that. So why would you then go into a virtual world where you then also have to just do a mundane job? It doesn't... I don't really see the entertainment factor here.
Oh, I think it's you know, the same as watching EastEnders. You know, these are people with relatively mundane lives. It's more kind of about a control and a simulation thing. You know, why SimCity is not particularly exciting. I mean, it's urban planning, but yet, you know, many people, including me, are addicted to playing it. I think there's just this aspect of kind of experimentation and control. I do think there is an issue with, you know, what The Sims teaches us. And listening to the interview when they said, you know, we don't include political statements in the game, etc. I mean, the fact that your character has to go and get a job and do particular kinds of things, you know, it's still indoctrinating people in a certain direction. So I think, you know, maybe the legacy will be in 20 years' time that everyone wanders around speaking in a funny language and doing really boring, mundane things.
All right, brilliant. Thank you very much, Bobby. And you can read up on all of our games coverage at guardian.co.uk/technology and on the games blog. Bobby, what else can we expect to see on the site this week?
Well, as you mentioned before, it's the quarter century anniversary of Tetris this week. So we've got some interviews. I did an interview with Alexei Pajitnov, who created Tetris, and Henk Rogers, who kind of did the deal to bring it to the masses through Nintendo. So we've got some stuff there and some space to reminisce about the first time you played Tetris and what that means for our lives today.
And I know as well we've got reports coming from the floor, from the Games Blog's Greg Howson, from The Guardian Steve Boxer, and from yourself as well, Bobby. Thank you very much. And you all know where to go, so put down that controller and get to it.
Well, as you can probably hear, I'm now out on the show floor where the games companies are all trying to woo us into buying their stuff. We've now seen what the big hardware makers have in store for us. It was a pretty quiet one for Nintendo, which announced some new Mario games, a new version of Wii Fit, and a little add-on for your Wiimote that makes it more precise. Sony, on the other hand, focused on the new PSP Go, a smaller version of the PSP that you might remember was widely leaked over the weekend. And they had a pretty exciting demo of a forthcoming motion control system that they're working on. But the winner so far looks like Microsoft, I think, which brought out stars like Paul McCartney, Steven Spielberg to back it up, and announced a host of new games and things like that. They've also added Facebook and Twitter integration to the Xbox 360, just as Jemima mentioned. And they showed off their own motion control system, pretty stunning one actually, called Project Natal, that it gets rid of the joystick entirely, so you control it through your movement and voice. Now, none of this is available to the public yet, and we're going to go and get our hands on all the goodies they've got on show. So we'll be telling you exactly what we think and what we find back on the games blog and the technology site all week.
Hello, I'm Jeff Jarvis with details of the latest Media Talk USA podcast. Newspaper publishers get together at a not-so-secret meeting to talk about pricing. Uh-oh, call in the antitrust lawyers. Plus, the New York Times creates its first social media editor. Let's hope she'll stop tweeting long enough to come in for us to ask her a few questions. Google does it again. Have they come up with the new news? And how dare the White House press secretary have a pop at British newspapers?
I think if you do an even moderate Google search, you're not going to find many of these newspapers and truth within, say, 25 words of each other.
Take the hard work out of listening and subscribe at guardian.co.uk/MediaTalkUSA.
Media Talk USA from The Guardian and paid content.
On the blogs this week, we've had a whole lot of commentary. Bobby, what's been your pick from technology?
Well, I enjoyed an exchange that went on a post about Craigslist that I did, an interview with the chief executive, Jim Buckmaster, last week. And, you know, there was lots of talk about whether Craigslist is right or wrong for having sex ads on. But then it kind of went off on a strange tangent. So Nega9000 said, "Wait, you can get sex on the internet now?" To which Auto Callback responded, "Wait, you can get something other than sex on the internet now."
Very funny.
But then Extel Dave jumped in with something that just made me laugh, which was, apparently, yes, you can get sex on something other than sex on the internet now. I found out by accident. I was looking for some red hot horny MILFs and accidentally purchased a 1985 Austin Maestro from some bloke in the West Midlands. I was shocked, I tell you.
Red hot horny MILF. I'm disturbed that I know what that means. Thank you very much, Bobby. And actually, that reminds me, in a couple of weeks' time, we've got a program that I've been looking forward to doing for ages. So make sure you've got your dial tuned here, as it were. Over on the games blog, I particularly like reading about reading the Peanut Gallery's deconstruction of computer games on TV. Made me cringe just a little bit. Owen Van Spall on the TV and radio blog wrote about Charlie Brooker's proposed new games-related program called Games Wipe, which is based on the format of his irreverent and hugely popular, in my house at least, Screen Wipe TV show. But really, really, is TV the medium for an interactive games program? Well, Ghosty says, "There simply is no necessity for a gaming-related television show because of the rise of podcasts, video content, gaming websites, news blogs, etc. I would like to hear Brooker's opinions on gaming, the culture behind it, the hype, the big business, the PR spin, but what benefit would there be to put it on television when he could just as easily upload a video of himself on YouTube?" Will, did you find something from the World Wide Web?
I did, actually. I was reading this story about the Wikipedia bans Church of Scientology from editing its site because apparently big fights break out about who's saying what about Scientology, whether it's pro or anti. Apparently you can't be in the middle on this. You have to have one side of it. And Chewtoy, who was one of the commenters on there, said that Christian fundamentalists have their own version of Wikipedia called Conservapedia. Apparently I've been there. It's fascinating.
Really?
Yeah, the dinosaurs entry is absolutely brilliant because it sort of says everything about what dinosaurs are and then references creationism and how... Oh. It's not really part of the plan. Apparently, 6,000 years ago was when dinosaurs were about the same time as man on Earth as
well. What the bleep do we know? Don't get me started. Anyway, yes.
So he was saying that conservative Christian fundamentalists have their own one, where their beloved prejudices can roam free, unhindered by facts. I suggest Scientologists do the same. And actually, I thought, how about if every group had their own Wikipedia? So you could have like the main Wikipedia, which has certain views in it, and then you could sort of have your Christian one, your Scientology one. Anyone could have their own Wikipedia.
I think actually this does raise an important point, which is whatever information is up there does have a frame that it's been put up there with. And whether Wikipedia is neutral or not, that's highly debated. You know, that does bring up an interesting criticism of the web and its content. What do you think, Bobby?
I'm dumbfounded by the postmodernness of it all, frankly.
Good. I like dumbfounding you, which reminds me, I expect to be dumbfounded by the picture of yourself that you're going to be putting up on our Flickr site.
Why do I have to do this?
Oh, because you're in your pajamas. Oh, and today, apparently, you are actually in pajamas.
A stripy set. Yes.
If you wouldn't mind, Bob, then please. And if you were at last week's Bristol road trip that Tech Weekly ran, please do put your pictures up on the Flickr site, which you can find at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Well, it's been a raucous one, fueled by good times and good coffee. I would particularly like to thank our special guests, Martin, Felix, and RJ, the team at The Sims, Jemima, for giving us good audio, and Will, Bobby, and producer Scott for being in the pod. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next Tuesday.